Chapter 16. The Ambassador's Boots.
My dear fellow, said Tuppence, and waved a heavily buttered muffin.
Tommy looked at her for a minute or two, then a broad grin spread over his face, and he murmured, We do have to be so very careful.
That's right, said Tuppence, delighted. You guessed. I am the famous Dr. Fortune, and you are Superintendent Bell.
Why are you being Reginald Fortune?
Well, really, because I feel like a lot of hot butter.
Well, that is the pleasant side of it, said Tommy. But there is another. You will have to examine horribly smashed faces and very extra dead bodies. A good deal. In answer, Tuppence threw across a letter. Tommy's eyebrows rose in astonishment.
Randolph Wilmot, the American ambassador. I wonder what he wants.
We shall know tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Punctually to the time named, Mr. Randolph Wilmot, United States ambassador to the Court of St. James, was ushered into Mr. Blunt's office. He cleared his throat and commenced speaking in a deliberate and characteristic manner.
I have come to you, Mr. Blunt. By the way, it is Mr. Blunt himself to whom I am speaking, is it not?
Oh, certainly, said Tommy.
I am Theodore Blunt, the head of the firm. I always prefer to deal with heads of departments, said Mr. Wilmot. It is more satisfactory in every way. As I was about to say, Mr. Blunt, this business gets my goat. There's nothing in it to trouble Scotland Yard about. I'm not a penny the worse in any way, and it's probably all due to a simple mistake. But all the same, I just don't see how that mistake arose. There's nothing criminal in it, I dare say, but I'd like to just get the whole thing straightened out. It makes me mad not to see the why and wherefore of a thing.
Oh, absolutely, said Tommy.
Mr. Wilmot went on. He was slow and given to much detail. At last, Tommy managed to get a word in.
Quite so, he said. The position is this. You arrived by the liner Nomadic a week ago. In some way, your kit bag and the kit bag of another gentleman, Mr. Ralph Westerham, whose initials are the same as yours, got mixed up. You took Mr. Westerham's kit bag and he took yours. Mr. Westerham discovered the mistake immediately, sent round your kit bag to the embassy, and took away his own. Am I right so far?
That is precisely what occurred. The two bags must have been practically identical, and with the initials R.W. being the same in both cases, it is not difficult to understand that an error might have been made. I myself was not aware of what had happened until my valet informed me of the mistake, and that Mr. Westerham, he is a senator, and a man for whom I have a great admiration, had sent round for his bag and returned mine.
Well, then, I didn't see,
but you will see. That's only the beginning of the story. Yesterday, as it chanced, I ran up against Senator Westerham, and I happened to mention the matter to him, jestingly. To my great surprise, he did not seem to know what I was talking about, and when I explained, he denied the story absolutely. He had not taken my bag off the ship in mistake for his own. In fact, he had not traveled with such an article amongst his luggage.
What an extraordinary thing.
Mr. Blunt, it is an extraordinary thing. There seems no rhyme or reason in it. Why, if anyone wanted to steal my kit bag, he could do so easily enough without resorting to all this roundabout business. And anyway, it was not stolen, but returned to me. On the other hand, if it was taken by mistake, why use Senator Westerham's name? It's a crazy business, but just for curiosity, I mean to get to the bottom of it. I hope the case is not too trivial for you to undertake.
Oh, not at all. It's a very intriguing little problem, capable, as you say, of many simple explanations, but nevertheless baffling on the face of it. The first thing, of course, is the reason of the substitution, if substitution it was. You say nothing was missing from your bag when it came back into your possession.
Well, my man says not. He would know.
What was in it, if I may ask?
Mostly boots.
Boots, said Tommy, discouraged.
Yes,
said Mr. Wilmot. Boots. Odd, isn't it?
You'll forgive my asking you, said Tommy, but you didn't carry any secret papers or anything of that sort sewn in the lining of a boot or screwed into a false heel?
The ambassador seemed amused by the question.
Secret diplomacy hasn't got to that pitch, I hope.
Only in fiction, said Tommy with an answering smile and a slightly apologetic manner.
But you see, we've got to account for the thing somehow.
Who came for the bag? The other bag, I mean.
Supposed to be one of Westerham's servants. Quite a quiet, ordinary man, so I understand. My valet saw nothing wrong with him.
Had it been unpacked, you know?
Well, that I can't say. I presume not.
But perhaps you'd like to ask the valet a few questions.
He can tell you more than I can about the business.
I think that would be the best plan, Mr. Wilmot. The ambassador scribbled a few words on a card and handed it to Tommy.
I opine that you would prefer to go round to the embassy and make your inquiries there. If not, I will have the man, his name is Richards, by the way, send round here.
No, thank you, Mr. Wilmot, I should prefer to go to the embassy. The ambassador rose, glancing at his watch.
Oh, dear me, I shall be late for an appointment.
Well, goodbye, Mr. Blunt.
I leave the matter in your hands.
He hurried away. Tommy looked at Tuppence, who had been scribbling demurely on her pad in the character of the efficient Miss Robinson.
What about it, old thing? He asked.
Do you see, as the old bird put it, any rhyme or reason in the proceedings?
None whatever, replied Tuppence cheerily.
Well, that's a start, anyway. It shows that there is really something very deep at the back of it.
You think so?
It's a generally accepted hypothesis. Remember Sherlock Holmes and the depth the butter had sunk into the parsley. I mean the other way round. I've always had a devouring wish to know all about that case. Perhaps Watson will disinter it from his notebook one of these days. Then I shall die happy. But we must get busy.
Quite so, said Tuppence.
Not a quick man, the esteemed Wilmot.
But sure.
She knows men, said Tommy.
Or do I say, he knows men?
It's so confusing when you assume the character of a male detective.
Oh, my dear fellow, my dear fellow!
A little more action, Tuppence, and a little less repetition.
A classic phrase cannot be repeated too often, said Tuppence with dignity.
Have a muffin, said Tommy kindly.
Not at 11 o'clock in the morning, thank you.
Silly case, this.
Boots, you know?
Why boots?
Well, said Tommy, why not?
It doesn't fit.
Boots.
She shook her head.
All wrong. Who wants other people's boots? The whole thing's mad.
Well, possibly they got hold of the wrong bag, suggested Tommy.
Well, that's possible.
But if they were after papers, a dispatch case would be more likely.
Papers are the only things one thinks of in connection with ambassadors.
Boots suggest footprints, said Tommy thoughtfully.
Do you think they wanted to lay a trail of Wilmot's footsteps somewhere?
Tuppence considered the suggestion, abandoning her role, then shook her head.
It seems wildly impossible, she said. No, I believe we shall have to resign ourselves to the fact that the boots have nothing to do with it.
Well, said Tommy with a sigh, the next step is to interview friend Richards. He may be able to throw some light on the mystery. On production of the ambassador's card, Tommy was admitted to the embassy, and presently a pale young man with a respectful manner and a subdued voice presented himself to undergo examination.
I am Richard, sir, Mr. Wilmot's valet. I understood you wished to see me?
Yes, Richards. Mr. Wilmot called on me this morning and suggested that I should come round and ask you a few questions. It is this matter of the kit bag.
Mr. Wilmot was rather upset over the affair, I know, sir. I can hardly see why, since no harm was done. I certainly understood from the man who called for the other bag that it belonged to Senator Westerham. But of course, I may have been mistaken.
What kind of man was he?
Middle-aged, grey hair, very good class, I should say most respectable. I understood he was Senator Westerham's valet. He left Mr. Wilmot's bag and took away the other.
Had it been unpacked at all?
Which one, sir?
Well, I meant the one you brought from the boat. But I should like to know about the other as well, Mr. Wilmot's own. Had that been unpacked, do you fancy?
I should say not, sir. It was just as I strapped it up on the boat. I should say the gentleman, whoever he was, just opened it, realized it wasn't his, and shut it up again.
Nothing missing? No small article?
I don't think so, sir. In fact, I'm quite sure.
And now the other one. Had you started to unpack that?
As a matter of fact, sir, I was just opening it at the very moment Senator Westrom's man arrived. I'd just undone the straps.
Did you open it at all?
We just unfastened it together, sir, to be sure no mistake had been made this time. The man said it was all right, and he strapped it up again and took it away.
What was inside? Boots also?
No, sir. Mostly toilet things, I fancy. I know I saw a tin of bath salts.
Tommy abandoned that line of research. You never saw anyone tampering with anything in your master's cabin on board ship, I suppose?
Oh, no, sir.
Never anything suspicious of any kind?
And what do I mean by that, I wonder, he thought to himself with a trace of amusement. Anything suspicious? Just words. But the man in front of him hesitated. Now that I remember it.
Yes, said Tommy eagerly. What?
I don't think it could have anything to do with it, but there was a young lady.
Yes? A young lady, you say. What was she doing?
She was taken faint, sir. A very pleasant young lady. Miss Eileen O'Hara, her name was. A dainty-looking lady, not tall, with black hair. Just a little foreign-looking.
Yes, said Tommy, with even greater eagerness.
As I was saying, she was taken queer, just outside Mr. Wilmot's cabin. She asked me to fetch the doctor. I helped her to the sofa, and then went off for the doctor. I was some time finding him, and when I found him and brought him back, the young lady was nearly all right again.
Oh, said Tommy.
You don't think, sir?
It's difficult to know what to think, said Tommy noncommittally. Was this Miss O'Hara traveling alone?
Yes, I think so, sir.
You haven't seen her since you landed?
No, sir.
Well, said Tommy after a minute or two spent in reflection, I think that's all. Thank you, Richards.
Thank you, sir.
Back at the office of the detective agency, Tommy retailed his conversation with Richards to Tuppence, who listened attentively. What do you think of it, Tuppence?
Oh, my dear fellow, we doctors are always skeptical of a sudden faintness, so very convenient. And Eileen, as well as O'Hara, almost too impossibly Irish, don't you think?
Well, it's something to go upon at last. Do you know what I'm going to do, Tuppence?
Advertise for the lady.
What?
Yes. Any information respecting Miss Eileen O'Hara, known to have travelled such and such a ship and such a date, either she'll answer it herself if she's genuine, or someone may come forward to give us information about her. So far, it's the only hope of a clue. You'll also put her on guard, remember?
Well, said Tommy, one's got to risk something.
I still can't see any sense in the thing, said Tuppence, frowning. If a gang of crooks get hold of the ambassador's bag for an hour or two and then send it back, what possible good could it do them?
Unless there are papers in it they want to copy. And Mr. Wilmot swears that there was nothing of the kind.
Tommy stared at her thoughtfully.
You put these things rather well, Tuppence, he said at last.
You've given me an idea.
It was 2 days later. Tuppence was out to lunch. Tommy, alone in the austere office of Mr. Theodore Blunt, was improving his mind by reading the latest sensational thriller. The door of the office opened and Albert appeared.
A young lady to see you, sir. Miss Cicely March. She says she has called in answer to an advertisement.
Oh, show her in at once, cried Tommy, thrusting his novel into a convenient drawer. In another minute, Albert had ushered in the young lady. Tommy had just time to see that she was fair-haired and extremely pretty, when the amazing occurrence happened. The door through which Albert had just passed out was rudely burst open. In the doorway stood a picturesque figure, a big, dark man, Spanish in appearance, with a flaming red tie. His features were distorted with rage, and in his hand was a gleaming pistol.
So, "This is the office of Mr. Busybody Blunt," he said. His voice was low and venomous. "Hands up at once, or I shoot."
It sounded no idle threat. Tommy's hands went up obediently. The girl, crouched against the wall, gave a gasp of terror.
"This young lady will come with me," said the man. "Yes, you will, my dear. You have never seen me before, but it doesn't matter. I can't have my plans ruined by a silly little chit like you. I seem to remember that you were one of the passengers on the Nomadic. You must have been peering into things that didn't concern you, but I've no intention of letting you blab any secrets to Mr. Blunt here. A very clever gentleman, Mr. Blunt, with his fancy advertisements. But as it happens, I keep an eye on the advertisement columns. That's how I got wise to this little game."
"You interest me exceedingly," said Tommy. "Won't you go on?"
"Cheek won't help you, Mr. Blunt. From now on, you're a marked man. Give up this investigation, and we'll leave you alone. Otherwise, God help you. Death comes swiftly to those who thwart our plans."
Tommy did not reply. He was staring over the intruder's shoulder as though he saw a ghost. As a matter of fact, he was seeing something that caused him far more apprehension than any ghost could have done. Up to now, he had not given a thought to Albert as a factor in the game. He had taken for granted that Albert had already been dealt with by the mysterious stranger. If he had thought of him at all, it was as one lying stunned on the carpet in the outer office. He now saw that Albert had miraculously escaped the stranger's attention, but instead of rushing out to fetch a policeman in good, sound British fashion, Albert had elected to play a lone hand. The door behind the stranger had opened noiselessly, and Albert stood in the aperture, enveloped in a coil of rope. An agonized yelp of protest burst from Tommy, but too late. Fired with enthusiasm, Albert flung a loop of rope over the intruder's head and jerked him backwards off his feet. The inevitable happened. The pistol went off with a roar, and Tommy felt the bullet scorch his ear in passing, ere it buried itself in the plaster behind him.
"I've got him, sir," cried Albert, flushed with triumph. "I've lassoed him. I've been practicing with a lasso in my spare time, sir. Can you give me a hand? He's very violent."
Tommy hastened to his faithful henchman's assistance, mentally determining that Albert should have no further spare time.
"You damned idiot," he said. "Why didn't you go for a policeman? Owing to this fool's play of yours, he's as near as anything plugged me through the head. Phew, I've never had such a near escape." "Lassoed him in the nick of time, I did," said Albert, his ardour quite undamped. "It's wonderful what those chaps can do on the prairie, sir."
"Quite so," said Tommy, "but we're not on the prairies. We happen to be in a highly civilized city. And now, my dear sir," he added to his prostrate foe, "what are we going to do with you?" A stream of oaths in a foreign language was his only reply.
"Hush," said Tommy. "I don't understand a word of what you're saying, but I've got a shrewd idea it's not the kind of language to use before a lady.
You'll excuse him, won't you, Miss... Do you know, in the excitement of this little upset, I've quite forgotten your name."
"March," said the girl. She was still white and shaken. But she came forward now and stood by Tommy, looking down on the recumbent figure of the discomfited stranger.
"What are you going to do with him?"
"I could fetch a bobby now,"
said Albert helpfully. But Tommy, looking up, caught a very faint negative movement of the girl's head and took his cue accordingly.
"We'll let him off this time," he remarked. "Nevertheless, I shall give myself the pleasure of kicking him downstairs, if it's only to teach him manners to a lady."
He removed the rope, hauled the victim to his feet, and propelled him briskly through the outer office. A series of shrill yelps was heard, and then a thud. Tommy came back, flushed but smiling. The girl was staring at him with round eyes.
"Did you hurt him?"
"I hope so," said Tommy. "But these Latin types make a practice of crying out before they're hurt, so I can't be quite sure about it. Shall we come back into my office, Miss March, and resume our interrupted conversation? I don't think we shall be interrupted again."
"I'll have my lasso ready, sir, in case," said the helpful Albert.
"Put it away," ordered Tommy sternly.
He followed the girl into the inner office and sat down at his desk, whilst she took a chair facing him.
"I don't quite know where to begin," said the girl. "As you heard that man say, I was a passenger on the Nomadic. The lady you advertise about, Miss O'Hara, was also on board."
"Exactly," said Tommy. "That we know already. But I suspect you must know something about her doings on board that boat, or else that picturesque gentleman would not have been in such a hurry to intervene.
I will tell you everything. The American ambassador was on board. One day, as I was passing his cabin, I saw this woman inside, and she was doing something so extraordinary that I stopped to watch. She had a man's boot in her hand.
A boot? Cried Tommy excitedly. I'm sorry, Miss March, go on.
With a little pair of scissors, she was slitting up the lining. Then she seemed to push something inside. Just at that minute, the doctor and another man came down the passage, and immediately she dropped back on the couch and groaned. I waited, and I gathered from what was being said that she had pretended to feel faint. I say pretended, because when I first caught sight of her, she was obviously feeling nothing of the kind.
Tommy nodded. Well,
I rather hate to tell you the next part. I was curious, and also I'd been reading silly books, and I wondered if she'd put a bomb or a poisoned needle or something like that in Mr. Wilmot's boot. I know it's absurd, but I did think so. Anyway, next time I passed the empty cabin, I slipped in and examined the boot. I drew out from the lining a slip of paper. Just as I had it in my hand, I heard the steward coming, and I hurried out so as not to be caught. The folded paper was still in my hand. When I got into my own cabin, I examined it. Mr. Blunt, it was nothing but some verses from the Bible.
Verses from the Bible? Said Tommy, very much intrigued.
At least, I thought so at the time. I couldn't understand it, but I thought perhaps it was the work of a religious maniac. Anyway, I didn't feel it was worthwhile replacing it. I kept it without thinking much about it until yesterday, when I used it to make into a boat for my little nephew to sail in his bath. As the paper got wet, I saw a queer kind of design coming out all over it. I hastily took it out of the bath and smoothed it out flat again. The water had brought out the hidden message. It was a kind of tracing and looked like the mouth of a harbour. Immediately after that, I read your advertisement.
Tommy sprang from his chair.
But this is most important. I see it all now. That tracing is probably the plan of some important harbour defences. It had been stolen by this woman. She feared someone was on her track, and not daring to conceal it amongst her own belongings, she contrived this hiding place. Later, she obtained possession of the bag in which the boot was packed, only to discover that the paper had vanished. Tell me, Miss March, you have brought this paper with you?
The girl shook her head.
It's at my place of business. I run a beauty parlor in Bond Street. I'm really an agent for the cyclamen preparations in New York. That's why I had been over there. I thought the paper might be important, so I locked it up in the safe before coming out. Ought not Scotland Yard to know about it?
Yes, indeed.
Then shall we go there now, get it out, and take it straight to Scotland Yard?
I am very busy this afternoon, said Tommy, adopting his professional manner and consulting his watch. The Bishop of London wants me to take up a case for him. A very curious problem concerning some vestments and two curates.
But then in that case, said Miss March, rising, I will go alone.
Tommy raised a hand in protest.
As I was about to say, he said, the bishop must wait. I will leave a few words with Albert.
I'm convinced, Miss March, that until that paper has been safely deposited with Scotland Yard, you are in active danger.
Do you think so? Said the girl doubtfully.
I don't think so. I'm sure. Excuse me. He scribbled some words on the pad in front of him, then tore off the leaf and folded it.
Taking his hat and stick, he intimated to the girl that he was ready to accompany her. In the outer office, he handed the folded paper to Albert, with an air of importance.
I'm called out on an urgent case. Explain that to his lordship if he comes. Here are my notes on the case for Miss Robinson.
Very good, sir, said Albert, playing up. And what about the Duchess's pearls?
Tommy waved his hand irritably. That must wait also.
He and Miss March hurried out. Halfway down the stairs, they encountered Tuppence coming up. Tommy passed her with a brusque,
Late again, Miss Robinson? I'm called out on an important case.
Tuppence stood still on the stairs and stared after them. Then, with raised eyebrows, she went on up to the office. As they reached the street, a taxi came sailing up to them. Tommy, on the point of hailing it, changed his mind.
Are you a good walker, Miss March? He asked seriously.
Yes. Why? Hadn't we better take that taxi? It'll be quicker.
Perhaps you did not notice. That taxi driver has just refused a fare a little lower down the street. He was waiting for us. Your enemies are on the lookout. If you feel equal to it, it would be better for us to walk to Bond Street. In the crowded streets, they will not be able to attempt much against us.
Very well, said the girl, rather doubtfully.
They walked westwards. The streets, as Tommy had said, were crowded, and progress was slow. Tommy kept a sharp lookout. Occasionally, he drew the girl to one side with a quick gesture, though she herself had seen nothing suspicious. Suddenly, glancing at her, he was seized with compunction.
I say, you look awfully done up. The shock of that man.
Come into this place and have a good cup of strong coffee. I suppose you wouldn't hear of a nip of brandy. The girl shook her head with a faint smile.
Coffee be it then, said Tommy. I think we can safely risk its being poisoned.
They lingered some time over their coffee, and finally set off at a brisker pace.
We've thrown them off, I think, said Tommy, looking over his shoulder.
Cyclamen Limited was a small establishment in Bond Street, with pale pink taffeta curtains, and one or two jars of face cream and a cake of soap decorating the window. Cicely March entered, and Tommy followed. The place inside was tiny. On the left was a glass counter with toilet preparations. Behind this counter was a middle-aged woman with grey hair and an exquisite complexion, who acknowledged Cicely March's entrance with a faint inclination of the head, before continuing to talk to the customer she was serving. This customer was a small, dark woman. Her back was to them, and they could not see her face. She was speaking in slow, difficult English. On the right was a sofa and a couple of chairs with some magazines on a table. Here sat two men, apparently bored husbands waiting for their wives. Cicely March passed straight on through a door at the end, which she held ajar for Tommy to follow her. As he did so, the woman customer exclaimed,
"Ah, but I think that is an amico of mine,"
and rushed after them, inserting her foot in the door just in time to prevent its closing. At the same time, the two men rose to their feet. One followed her through the door. The other advanced to the shop attendant and clapped his hand over her mouth to drown the scream rising to her lips. In the meantime, things were happening rather quickly beyond the swing door. As Tommy passed through, a cloth was flung over his head and a sickly odour assailed his nostrils. Almost as soon, however, it was jerked off again and a woman's scream rang out. Tommy blinked a little and coughed as he took in the scene in front of him. On his right was the mysterious stranger of a few hours ago, and busily fitting handcuffs upon him was one of the bored men from the shop parlour. Just in front of him was Cicely March, wrestling vainly to free herself, whilst the woman customer from the shop held her firmly pinioned. As the latter turned her head, and the veil she wore unfastened itself and fell off, the well-known features of Tuppence were revealed.
"Well done, Tuppence," said Tommy, moving forward. "Let me give you a hand. I shouldn't struggle if I were you, Miss O'Hara. Or do you prefer to be called Miss March?"
"This is Inspector Grace, Tommy," said Tuppence. "As soon as I read the note you left, I rang up Scotland Yard, and Inspector Grace and another man met me outside here."
"Very glad to get hold of this gentleman," said the inspector, indicating his prisoner. "He's wanted badly. But we've never had cause to suspect this place. Thought it was a genuine beauty shop."
"You see," explained Tommy gently, "we do have to be so very careful. Why would anyone want the ambassador's bag for an hour or so? I put the question the other way round, supposing it was the other bag that was the important one. Someone wanted that bag to be in the ambassador's possession for an hour or so. Much more illuminating. Diplomatic luggage is not subjected to the indignities of a customs examination. Clearly smuggling. But smuggling of what? Nothing too bulky. At once I thought of drugs. Then that picturesque comedy was enacted in my office. They'd seen my advertisement and wanted to put me off the scent, or failing that, out of the way altogether. But I happened to notice an expression of blank dismay in the charming lady's eyes when Albert did his lasso act. That didn't fit in very well with her supposed part. The stranger's attack was meant to assure my confidence in her. I played the part of the credulous sleuth with all my might, swallowed her rather impossible story, and permitted her to lure me here, carefully leaving behind full instructions for dealing with the situation.
under various pretexts, I delayed our arrival so as to give you all plenty of time. Cicely March was looking at him with a stony expression.
You are mad. What do you expect to find here?
Remembering that Richard saw a tin of bath salts, what do you say about beginning with the bath salts, eh, Inspector?
A very sound idea, sir.
He picked up one of the dainty pink tins and emptied it on the table. The girl laughed.
Genuine crystals, eh?
Said Tommy.
Nothing more deadly than carbonate of soda.
Try the safe, suggested Tuppence.
There was a small wall safe in the corner. The key was in the lock. Tommy swung it open and gave a shout of satisfaction. The back of the safe opened out into a big recess in the wall, and that recess was stacked with the same elegant tins of bath salts, rows and rows of them. He took one out and prized up the lid. The top showed the same pink crystals, but underneath was a fine white powder. The inspector uttered an ejaculation.
You've got it, sir. 10 to 1, that tin's full of pure cocaine.
We knew there was a distributing area somewhere around here, handy to the West End, but we haven't been able to get a clue to it.
This is a fine coup of yours, sir.
Rather a triumph for Blunt's brilliant detectives, said Tommy to Tuppence as they emerged into the street together. It's a great thing to be a married man. Your persistent schooling has at last taught me to recognize peroxide when I see it. Golden hair has got to be the genuine article to take me in. We will concoct a businesslike letter to the ambassador, informing him that the matter has been dealt with satisfactorily. And now, my dear fellow, what about tea and lots of hot buttered muffins? Chapter 17. The Man Who Was Number 16. Tommy and Tuppence were closeted with the chief in his private room. His commendation had been warm and sincere.
You've succeeded admirably. Thanks to you, we have laid our hands on no less than 5 very interesting personages, and from them we have received much valuable information. Meanwhile, I learn from a creditable source that headquarters in Moscow have taken alarm at the failure of their agents to report. I think that in spite of all our precautions, they've begun to suspect that all is not well at what I may call the distributing center, the office of Mr. Theodore Blunt, the International Detective Bureau.
Well, said Tommy, I suppose they were bound to tumble to it sometime or other, sir.
As you say, it was only to be expected. But I am a little worried about Mrs. Tommy.
Oh, I can look after her all right, sir, said Tommy at exactly the same minute as Tuppence said. I can take care of myself.
Said Mr. Carter. Excessive self-confidence was always a characteristic of you two. Whether your immunity is entirely due to your own superhuman cleverness, or whether a small percentage of luck creeps in, I'm not prepared to say. But luck changes, you know. However, I won't argue the point. From my extensive knowledge of Mrs. Tommy, I suppose it's quite useless to ask her to keep out of the limelight for the next week or two.
Tuppence shook her head very energetically.
Then, all I can do is give you all the information that I can. We have reason to believe that a special agent has been dispatched from Moscow to this country. We don't know what name he is traveling under. We don't know when he will arrive. But we do know something about him. He is a man who gave us great trouble in the war. A ubiquitous kind of fellow who turned up all over the place, where we least wanted him. He is a Russian by birth and an accomplished linguist. So much so that he can pass as 6 other nationalities, including our own. He's also a past master in the art of disguise, and he has brains. It was he who devised the number 16 code. When and how he will turn up, I do not know, but I'm fairly certain that he will turn up. We do know this. He was not personally acquainted with the real Mr. Theodore Blunt. I think that he will turn up at your office on the pretext of a case which he will wish you to take up, and will try you with the passwords. The first, as you know, is the mention of the number 16, which is replied to by a sentence containing the same number. The second, which you have only just learnt, is an inquiry as to whether you have ever crossed the channel. The answer to that is,
I was in Berlin on the 13th of last month. As far as we know, that is all. I would suggest that you reply correctly, and so endeavour to gain his confidence. Sustain the fiction if you possibly can. But even if he appears to be completely deceived, remain on your guard. Our friend is particularly astute, and can play a double game as well or better than you can. But in either case, I hope to get him through you. From this day forward, I am adopting special precautions. A dictaphone was installed last night in your office, so that one of my men in the room below will be able to hear everything that passes in your office. In this way, I shall be immediately informed if anything arises, and can take the necessary steps to safeguard you and your wife whilst securing the man I am after. After a few more instructions and a general discussion of tactics, the two young people departed and made their way as rapidly as possible to the offices of Blunt's brilliant detectives. "It's late," said Tommy, looking at his watch. "Just on 12 o'clock. We've been a long time with the chief. I hope we haven't missed a particularly spicy case."
"On the whole," said Tuppence, "we've not done badly. I was tabulating results the other day. We've solved 4 baffling murder mysteries, rounded up a gang of counterfeiters, ditto gang of smugglers, actually 2 gangs," interpolated Tommy.
"So we have. I'm glad of that.
Gangs sound so professional."
Tuppence continued, ticking off the items on her fingers.
"1 jewel robbery, 2 escapes from violent death, 1 case of missing lady reducing her figure, 1 young girl befriended, an alibi successfully exploded, and, alas, 1 case where we made utter fools of ourselves. On the whole, jolly good. We're very clever, I think."
"You would think so," said Tommy. "You always do. Now, I have a secret feeling that once or twice we've been rather lucky."
"Nonsense," said Tuppence. "All done by the little grey cells."
"Well, I was damn lucky once," said Tommy, "the day Albert did his lasso act."
"But you speak, Tuppence, as though it was all over."
"Well, so it is," said Tuppence.
She lowered her voice impressively. "This is our last case. When they have laid the super spy by the heels, the great detectives intend to retire and take to beekeeping or vegetable marrow growing. It's always done."
"Tired of it, eh?"
"Yes, I think I am. Besides, we're so successful now, the luck might change."
"Well, who's talking about luck now?" asked Tommy triumphantly. At that moment, they turned in at the doorway of the block of buildings in which the International Detective Bureau had its offices, and Tuppence did not reply. Albert was on duty in the outer office, employing his leisure in balancing, or endeavouring to balance, the office ruler upon his nose. With a stern frown of reproof, the great Mr. Blunt passed into his own private office. Divesting himself of his overcoat and hat, he opened the cupboard, on the shelves of which reposed his classic library of the great detectives of fiction. "The choice narrows," murmured Tommy. "On whom shall I model myself today?" Tuppence's voice, with an unusual note in it, made him turn sharply.
"Tommy," she said, "what day of the month is it?"
Let me see, the 11th, why?"
"Look at the calendar."
Hanging on the wall was one of those calendars from which you tear a leaf every day. It bore the legend of Sunday the 16th. Today was Monday. "By Jove, that's odd. Albert must have torn off too many. Careless little devil."
"I don't believe he did," said Tuppence. "But we'll ask him."
Albert, summoned and questioned, seemed very astonished. He swore he had only torn off 2 leaves, those of Saturday and Sunday. His statement was presently supported, for whereas the 2 leaves torn off by Albert were found in the grate, the succeeding ones were lying neatly in the waste paper basket. "A neat and methodical criminal," said Tommy. "Who's been here this morning, Albert? A client of any kind?"
"Well, just one, sir."
"What was he like?"
"It was a she, a hospital nurse. Very upset and anxious to see you. Said she'd wait until you came. I put her in Clark's because it was warmer.
And from there she could walk in here, of course, without your seeing her."
"How long has she been gone?"
"About half an hour, sir.
Said she'd call again this afternoon.
A nice, motherly-looking body."
"A nice, motherly... Oh, get out, Albert."
Albert withdrew, injured. "Queer start, that," said Tommy. "It seems a little purposeless. Puts us on our guard. I suppose there isn't a bomb concealed in the fireplace or anything of that kind."
He reassured himself on that point, then he seated himself at the desk and addressed Tuppence.
"Mon ami," he said, "we are here faced with a matter of the utmost gravity. You recall, do you not, the man who was number 4, him whom I crushed like an eggshell in the Dolomites with the aid of high explosives, bien entendu. But he was not really dead. Ah, no, they are never really dead, these supercriminals. This is the man. But even more so, if I may put it, he is the 4 squared. In other words, he is now the number 16. You comprehend, my friend?"
"Perfectly," said Tuppence.
"You are the great Hercule Poirot."
"Exactly. No moustaches, but lots of grey cells."
"I've a feeling," said Tuppence, "that this particular adventure will be called the Triumph of Hastings."
"Never," said Tommy. "It isn't done. Once the idiot friend, always the idiot friend. There is an etiquette in these matters.
By the way, mon ami, can you not part your hair in the middle instead of one side? The present effect is unsymmetrical and deplorable."
The buzzer rang sharply on Tommy's desk. He returned the signal, and Albert appeared, bearing a card.
"Prince Vladirovsky," read Tommy in a low voice. He looked at Tuppence. "I wonder. Show him in, Albert." The man who entered was of middle height, graceful in bearing, with a fair beard, and apparently about 35 years of age.
"Mr. Blunt," he inquired,
"you have been most highly recommended to me. Will you take up a case for me?"
"If you will give me the details."
"Certainly. It concerns the daughter of a friend of mine, a girl of 16. We are anxious for no scandal, you understand?"
"My dear sir," said Tommy, "this business has been running successfully for 16 years, owing to our strict attention to that particular principle."
He fancied he saw a sudden gleam in the other's eye. If so, it passed as quickly as it came.
"You have branches, I believe, on the other side of the channel."
"Oh yes, as a matter of fact," he brought out the word with great deliberation, "I myself was in Berlin on the 13th of last month."
"In that case," said the stranger, "it is hardly necessary to keep up the little fiction. The daughter of my friend can be conveniently dismissed. You know who I am. At any rate, I see you have had warning of my coming." He nodded towards the calendar on the wall.
"Quite so," said Tommy.
"My friends, I have come over here to investigate matters."
"What has been happening?"
"Treachery," said Tuppence, no longer able to remain quiescent. The Russian shifted his attention to her and raised his eyebrows.
"Aha, that is so, is it? I thought as much. Was it Sergius?"
"We think so," said Tuppence unblushingly.
"It would not surprise me. But you yourselves, you are under no suspicion?"
"I do not think so. We handle a good deal of bona fide business, you see," explained Tommy. The Russian nodded.
"That is wise. All the same, I think it would be better if I did not come here again. For the moment, I am staying at the Blitz. I will take Marie's. This is Marie's, I suppose?"
Tuppence nodded.
"What is she known as here?"
"Oh, Miss Robinson."
"Very well, Miss Robinson, you will return with me to the Blitz and lunch with me there. We will all meet at headquarters at 3 o'clock. Is that clear?"
He looked at Tommy.
"Perfectly clear," replied Tommy, wondering where on earth headquarters might be. But he guessed that it was just those headquarters that Mr. Carter was so anxious to discover.
Tuppence rose and slipped on her long black coat with its leopard-skin collar. Then demurely, she declared herself ready to accompany the prince. They went out together, and Tommy was left behind, a prey to conflicting emotions. Supposing something had gone wrong with the dictaphone? Supposing the mysterious hospital nurse had somehow or other learnt of its installation and had rendered it useless? He seized the telephone and called a certain number. There was a moment's delay, and then a well-known voice spoke.
"Quiet. Okay. Come round to the Blitz at once."
5 minutes later, Tommy and Mr. Carter met in the palm court of the Blitz. The latter was crisp and reassuring.
"You've done excellently. The prince and the little lady are at lunch in the restaurant. I've got 2 of my men in there as waiters. Whether he suspects or whether he doesn't,
and I'm fairly sure he doesn't, we've got him on toast. There are two men posted upstairs to watch his suite, and more outside ready to follow wherever they go. Don't be worried about your wife. She'll be kept in sight the whole time. I'm not going to run any risks. Occasionally, one of the Secret Service men came to report progress. The first time it was a waiter who took their orders for cocktails. The second time it was a fashionable, vacant-faced young man. They're coming out, said Mr. Carter. We'll retire behind this pillar, in case they sit down here, but I fancy he'll take her up to his suite. Ah, yes. I thought so. From their post of vantage, Tommy saw the Russian and Tuppence cross the hall and enter the lift. The minutes passed, and Tommy began to fidget. Do you think, sir, I mean, alone in that suite, one of my men's inside, behind the sofa. Don't worry, man. A waiter crossed the hall and came up to Mr. Carter. Got the signal they were coming up, sir, but they haven't come. Is it all right? What? Mr. Carter spun round. I saw them go into the lift myself, just. He glanced up at the clock. 4.5 minutes ago. And they haven't shown up? He hurried across to the lift, which had just at that moment come down again, and spoke to the uniformed attendant. You took a gentleman with a fair beard and a young lady a few minutes ago to the second floor? Oh, not to the second floor, sir. Third floor, the gentleman asked for. Oh. The chief jumped in, motioning Tommy to accompany him. Take us up to the third floor, please. I don't understand this, he murmured in a low voice, but keep calm. Every exit from the hotel is watched, and I've got a man on the third floor as well, on every floor, in fact. I was taking no chances. The lift door opened on the third floor, and they sprang out, hurrying down the corridor. Halfway along it, a man dressed as a waiter came to meet them. It's all right, Chief. They're in number 318. Carter breathed a sigh of relief. Well, that's all right. No other exit? It's a suite, but there are only these two doors into the corridor, and to get out from any of these rooms, they'd have to pass us to get to the staircase or the lifts. Well, that's all right, then. Just telephone down and find out who's supposed to occupy this suite. The waiter returned in a minute or two. Mrs. Cortland Van Snyder of Detroit. Mr. Carter became very thoughtful. I wonder now, is this Mrs. Van Snyder an accomplice, or is she... He left the sentence unfinished. Hear any noise from inside? He asked abruptly. Not a thing. But the doors fit well. One couldn't hope to hear much. Mr. Carter made up his mind suddenly. I don't like this business. We're going in. Got the master key? Of course, sir. Call up Evans and Clydesley. Reinforced by the other two men, they advanced towards the door of the suite. It opened noiselessly when the first man inserted his key. They found themselves in a small hall. To the right was the open door of a bathroom, and in front of them was the sitting room. On the left was a closed door, and from behind it a faint sound, rather like an asthmatic pug, could be heard. Mr. Carter pushed the door open and entered. The room was a bedroom, with a big double bed, ornately covered with a bedspread of rose and gold. On it, bound hand and foot, with her mouth secured by a gag, and her eyes almost starting out of her head with pain and rage, was a middle-aged, fashionably dressed woman. On a brief order from Mr. Carter, the other men had covered the whole suite. Only Tommy and his chief had entered the bedroom. As he leant over the bed and strove to unfasten the knots, Carter's eyes went roving round the room in perplexity. Save for an immense quantity of truly American luggage, the room was empty. There was no sign of the Russian or Tuppence. In another minute, the waiter came hurrying in and reported that the other rooms were also empty. Tommy went to the window, only to draw back and shake his head. There was no balcony, nothing but a sheer drop to the street below. "Certain it was this room they entered?" asked Carter peremptorily. "Sure. Besides," the man indicated the woman on the bed. With the aid of a penknife, Carter parted the scarf that was half choking her, and it was at once clear that whatever her sufferings, they had not deprived Mrs. Cortland Van Snyder of the use of her tongue. When she had exhausted her first indignation, Mr. Carter spoke mildly. "Would you mind telling me exactly what happened from the beginning?"
"I guess I'll sue the hotel for this. It's a perfect outrage. I was just looking for my bottle of Killer Grip when a man sprung on me from behind and broke a little glass bottle right under my nose, and before I could get my breath, I was all in. When I came to, I was lying here, all trussed up, and goodness knows what happened to my jewels. He's gotten the lot, I guess.
Your jewels are quite safe, I fancy, said Carter dryly. He wheeled round and picked up something from the floor.
You were standing just where I am when he sprang upon you?
That's so, assented Mrs. Van Snyder. It was a fragment of thin glass that Mr. Carter had picked up. He sniffed it and handed it to Tommy.
Ethyl chloride, he murmured. Instant anesthetic, but it only keeps one under for a moment or two.
Surely he must still have been in the room when you came too, Mrs. Van Snyder.
Isn't that what I'm telling you? Oh, it drove me half crazy to see him getting away and me not able to move or do anything at all.
Getting away? Said Mr. Carter sharply. Which way?
Through that door.
She pointed to one in the opposite wall.
He had a girl with him, but she seemed kind of limp as though she'd had a dose of the same dope.
Carter looked a question at his henchman. Leads into the next suite, sir. But double doors. Supposed to be bolted on each side.
Mr. Carter examined the door carefully. Then he straightened himself up and turned towards the bed.
Mrs. Van Snyder, he said quietly, do you still persist in your assertion that the man went out this way?
Why, certainly he did. Why shouldn't he?
Because the door happens to be bolted on this side, said Mr. Carter dryly. He rattled the handle as he spoke. A look of the utmost astonishment spread over Mrs. Van Snyder's face.
Unless someone bolted the door behind him, said Mr. Carter, he cannot have gone out that way.
He turned to Evans, who had just entered the room.
Sure they're not anywhere in this suite? Any other communicating doors?
No, sir.
And I'm quite sure.
Carter turned his gaze this way and that about the room. He opened the big hanging wardrobe, looked under the bed, up the chimney, and behind all the curtains. Finally, struck by a sudden idea, and disregarding Mrs. Van Snyder's shrill protests, he opened the large wardrobe trunk and rummaged swiftly in the interior. Suddenly, Tommy, who had been examining the communicating door, gave an exclamation.
Come here, sir. Look at this. They did go this way.
The bolt had been very cleverly filed through, so close to the socket that the join was hardly perceptible.
The door won't open because it's locked on the other side, explained Tommy.
In another minute, they were out in the corridor again, and the waiter was opening the door of the adjoining suite with his pass key. This suite was untenanted. When they came to the communicating door, they saw that the same plan had been adopted. The bolt had been filed through, and the door was locked, the key having been removed. But nowhere in the suite was there any sign of Tuppence or the fair-bearded Russian, and there was no other communicating door, only the one on the corridor.
But I'd have seen them come out, protested the waiter. I couldn't have helped seeing them. I can take my oath they never did.
Damn it all, cried Tommy. They can't have vanished into thin air. Carter was calm again now, his keen brain working.
Telephone down and find out who had this suite last and when.
Evans, who had come with them, leaving Clydesley on guard in the other suite, obeyed. Presently, he raised his head from the telephone.
An invalid French lad. Monsieur Paul de Verres. He had a hospital nurse with him. They left this morning.
An exclamation burst from the other Secret Service man, the waiter. He had gone deathly pale.
The invalid boy. The hospital nurse, he stammered. They passed me in the passage. I never dreamed. I'd seen them so often before.
Are you sure they were the same? Cried Mr. Carter. Are you sure, man? You looked at them well?
The man shook his head. I hardly glanced at them. I was waiting, you understand, on the alert for the others, the man with the fair beard and the girl.
Of course, said Mr. Carter with a groan. They counted on that. With a sudden exclamation, Tommy stooped down and pulled something from under the sofa. It was a small, rolled-up bundle of black. Tommy unrolled it, and several articles fell out. The outside wrapper was the long black coat Tuppence had worn that day. Inside was her walking dress, her hat, and a long, fair beard.
It's clear enough now, he said bitterly. They've got her. Got Tuppence. That Russian devil has given us the slip. The hospital nurse and the boy were accomplices.
They stayed here for a day or two to get the hotel people accustomed to their presence. The man must have realized at lunch that he was trapped and proceeded to carry out his plan. Probably he counted on the room next door being empty, since it was when he fixed the bolts. Anyway, he managed to silence both the woman next door and Tuppence. Brought her in here, dressed her in boy's clothes, altered his own appearance, and walked out bold as brass. The clothes must have been hidden ready. But I don't quite see how he managed Tuppence's acquiescence.
I can see, said Mr. Carter.
He picked up a little shining piece of steel from the carpet.
That's a fragment of a hypodermic needle. She was doped.
My God, groaned Tommy. And he's got clear away.
We don't know that, said Carter quickly. Remember, every exit is watched.
For a man and a girl, not for a hospital nurse and an invalid boy. They'll have left the hotel by now.
Such, on inquiry, proved to be the case. The nurse and her patient had driven away in a taxi some 5 minutes earlier.
Look here, Beresford, said Mr. Carter. For God's sake, pull yourself together. You know that I won't leave a stone unturned to find that girl.
I'm going back to my office at once, and in less than 5 minutes, every resource of the department will be at work. We'll get them yet.
Will you, sir? He's a clever devil, that Russian. Look at the cunning of this coup of his. But I know you'll do your best. Only pray God it's not too late. They've got it in for us. Badly.
He left the Blitz Hotel and walked blindly along the street, hardly knowing where he was going. He felt completely paralyzed. Where to search? What to do? He went into the Green Park and dropped down upon a seat. He hardly noticed when someone else sat down at the opposite end and was quite startled to hear a well-known voice.
If you please, sir, if I might make so bold.
Tommy looked up.
Hello, Albert, he said dully.
I know all about it, sir, but don't take on so.
Don't take on?
He gave a short laugh. Easily said, isn't it?
Ah, but think, sir. Blunt's brilliant detectives. Never beaten. And if you'll excuse my saying so, I am to overhear what you and the missus was ragging about this morning. Mr. Poirot and his little grey cells.
Well, sir, why not use your little grey cells and see what you can do?
It's easier to use your little grey cells in fiction than it is in fact, my boy.
Well, said Albert stoutly, I don't believe anybody could put the missus out for good and all.
You know what she is, sir. Just like one of them rubber bones you buy for little dogs. Guaranteed, indestructible.
Albert, said Tommy, you cheer me.
Then what about using your little grey cells, sir?
You're a persistent lad, Albert. Playing the fool has served us pretty well up till now. We'll try it again. Let us arrange our facts neatly, and with method. At 2:10 exactly, our quarry enters the lift. 5 minutes later, we speak to the lift man, and having heard what he says, we also go up to the third floor. At, say, 2:19, we enter the suite of Mrs. Van Snyder. And now, what significant fact strikes us? There was a pause. No significant fact striking either of them.
Well, there wasn't such a thing as a trunk in the room, was there?
Asked Albert. His eyes lighting suddenly.
Mon ami, said Tommy, you do not understand the psychology of an American woman who has just returned from Paris. There were, I should say, about 19 trunks in the room.
What I mean to say is, a trunk's a handy thing if you've got a dead body about, and you want to get rid of... Not that she is dead, for a minute.
We searched the only two there were big enough to contain a body. What is the next fact, in chronological order?
Well, you've missed one out. When the missus and the bloke dressed up as a hospital nurse passed the waiter in the passage.
It must have been just before we came up in the lift, said Tommy. They must have had a narrow escape of meeting us face to face. Pretty quick work, that. He stopped.
What is it, sir?
Be silent, mon ami. I have the kind of little idea.
Colossal. Stupendous, that always comes sooner or later to Hercule Poirot.
But if so, if that's it,
oh Lord.
I hope I'm in time, He raced out of the park, Albert hard on his heels, inquiring breathlessly as he ran, "What's up, sir? I don't understand."
"That's all right," said Tommy. "You're not supposed to. Hastings never did. If your grey cells weren't of a very inferior order to mine, what fun do you think I should get out of this game? I'm talking damn rot, but I can't help it. You're a good lad, Albert. You know what Tuppence is worth. She's worth a dozen of you and me."
Thus, talking breathlessly as he ran, Tommy re-entered the portals of the Blitz. He caught sight of Evans and drew him aside with a few hurried words. The two men entered the lift, Albert with them.
"Third floor," said Tommy.
At the door of number 318, they paused. Evans had a passkey and used it forthwith. Without a word of warning, they walked straight into Mrs. Van Snyder's bedroom. The lady was still lying on the bed, but was now arrayed in a becoming negligee. She stared at them in surprise.
"Pardon my failure to knock," said Tommy pleasantly, "but I want my wife. Do you mind getting off that bed?"
"I guess you've gone plumb crazy," cried Mrs. Van Snyder. Tommy surveyed her thoughtfully, his head on one side.
"Very artistic," he pronounced, "but it won't do. We looked under the bed, but not in it. I remember using that hiding place myself when young. Horizontally across the bed, underneath the bolster. And that nice wardrobe trunk all ready to take away the body in later. But we were a bit too quick for you just now. You'd had time to dope Tuppence, put her under the bolster, and be gagged and bound by your accomplices next door, and I'll admit we swallowed your story all right for the moment. But when one came to think it out with order and method, impossible to drug a girl, dress her in boys' clothes, gag and bind another woman, and change one's own appearance all in 5 minutes. Simply a physical impossibility. The hospital nurse and the boy were to be a decoy. We were to follow that trail, and Mrs. Van Snyder was to be pitted as a victim. Just help the lady off the bed, will you, Evans? You have your automatic? Good." Protesting shrilly, Mrs. Van Snyder was hauled from her place of repose. Tommy tore off the coverings and the bolster. There, lying horizontally across the top of the bed, was Tuppence, her eyes closed and her face waxen. For a moment, Tommy felt a sudden dread. Then he saw the slight rise and fall of her breast. She was drugged, not dead. He turned to Albert and Evans.
"And now, messieurs," he said dramatically, "the final coup." With a swift, unexpected gesture, he seized Mrs. Van Snyder by her elaborately dressed hair. It came off in his hand.
"As I thought," said Tommy. "Number 16.
It was about half an hour later when Tuppence opened her eyes and found a doctor and Tommy bending over her. Over the events of the next quarter of an hour, a discreet veil had better be drawn. But after that period, the doctor departed with the assurance that all was now well.
"Mon ami Hastings," said Tommy fondly, "how I rejoice that you are still alive.
Have we got number 16?
"Once more, I have crushed him like an eggshell. In other words, Carter's got him. The little grey cells.
By the way, I'm raising Albert's wages."
"Tell me all about it."
Tommy gave her a spirited narrative, with certain omissions.
"Weren't you half frantic about me?" asked Tuppence faintly.
"Oh, not particularly. One must keep calm, you know."
"Liar," said Tuppence. "You look quite haggard still."
"Well, perhaps I was just a little worried, darling. I say, we're going to give it up now, aren't we?"
"Oh, certainly we are."
Tommy gave a sigh of relief.
"I hoped you'd be sensible, after a shock like this."
"Oh, it's not the shock. You know I never mind shocks."
"A rubber bone, indestructible," murmured Tommy.
"I've got something better to do," continued Tuppence. "Something ever so much more exciting. Something I've never done before." Tommy looked at her with lively apprehension.
"I forbid it, Tuppence."
"You can't," said Tuppence. "It's a law of nature."
"What are you talking about, Tuppence?"
"I'm talking," said Tuppence, "of our baby. Wives don't whisper nowadays, they shout.
our baby!
Tommy, isn't everything marvellous?
We hope you have enjoyed Partners in Crime by Agatha Christie, performed by Hugh Fraser. Partners in Crime text copyright 1929 Agatha Christie Limited. Production copyright 2007 HarperCollins Publishers Limited. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.